Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
And welcome back to another episode of...
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Wow.
Very quiet.
Yes.
Yeah, very quiet.
So, hello and welcome to Mostly Lit.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm Derek Owusu.
I'm Alex Reeds.
I'm Ray Furfeek.
And we love to welcome Lenny Henry to the show.
Very nice to be here. Thank you. I'm in another world now. This is this is podcast land. Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen?
Who knows?
So we're in basically a literature and film pop culture podcast. We record every week. We've been going consistently for about 3 years now. Every single week, uploading podcasts and recording podcasts, and it's very tiring, but it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
So what we'll do today is we will kind of give you guys a taste of what it feels like to listen to our podcast, kind of go through the structure of it in terms of just talking. And then you never know, maybe you might leave and subscribe. And we'll be talking to Lenny Henry about all the amazing things that he's been doing. So yeah, guys, let's get started. So, Alex.
How has your Cheltenham been, guys?
It's been fun.
What have you guys been up to?
What have you been up to, Derek?
I didn't manage to get to go to all of the events because a lot of them were sold out.
Yeah.
Obviously, Sir Lenny's event was sold out. But
mine was rammed.
Yeah. So
you couldn't get in mine.
You couldn't get in.
I knew somebody. I could have got you in if you just called me.
Yeah.
I could have got you in, but mine was rammed.
Yeah, so I didn't get to go in there, but I managed to make it to Carla and Anthony and Anaxaguru's in conversation, which was very, that was rammed as well, but luckily we got tickets, which was very, very interesting. You know, you watch a Carla on TV, what have, and I think, okay, you know, I was thinking, oh, maybe he's very, very media trained, but then seeing him talk is unreal.
Yeah.
Could you explain who Akala is for people who don't know?
Yeah, so Akala is basically a rapper, writer. I believe he rap plays, and he founded the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, which was trying to get, you know, young people in urban areas to engage with Shakespeare a lot better. And he's just released Natives, which is a Sunday Times bestseller. Amazing book as well. It's basically the history of empire and intertwined with his life as well growing up in London.
Extraordinary guy.
Yeah very amazing. Very interesting.
And a really big activist with regard to Grenfell too, yeah?
Yes, yes, he definitely is. Very, very outspoken. Takes a lot of people to task who think that they can talk him down because he's a rapper, but it really shows them what he's made of.
Akala's really smart.
It really shows them something, yeah. So that's been my highlight of Cheltenham so far.
I mean, we did a panel yesterday on how we used our passions for books to bring it into the digital space, and that was amazing. I was on there with Simon Savage and Jenny Campbell, who are book bloggers and vloggers on YouTube, and they do podcasts as well. It was hosted by Sarah Shafi, and it made me realize, like, kind of my journey through books and how we how we got here to this point, you know what I mean, like creating the podcast, because we all love books, we love reading, we love having these discussions sort of thing. And that was one of the big highlights for me, just having that discussion and kind of working my way, like we had to work our way backwards and figure out where we started reading, what we loved, and then like figuring out that, you know, I mentioned the Harry Potter phase, mentioned the fantasy book phase, then like diverting into crime fiction, and then broadening it out into general fiction.
Harry Potter phase.
Yeah, we had a Harry Potter phase. I had a Harry Potter phase.
That's great. Ravenclaw. I read every single Harry Potter book to my daughter.
Yeah.
And did all the voice. I think every actor did this. Did all the voices. Did damn Stephen Fry. And I did everything until the Half-Blood Prince.
Oh, man.
And my daughter was like 14 or something. And I started the book, and about 4 chapters in, my daughter said, "Dad, I've got this.
Oh.
I'm going to read this myself, all right?"
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And I didn't want to give it up.
Yeah.
So I'd be in a cupboard just reading it to myself. But eventually she just read the book herself. But I literally had to read the rest of the Harry Potter books to finish the cycle of stories. Because I realised that I'd become addicted to it by reading it every night.
The Half-Blood Prince, is that the fourth one?
The Deadly Half.
Dad, you don't know what you're talking about. Stay away.
Have you not finished it?
No. I haven't read any of them.
Yeah.
No, I haven't read
You've
any
got a treat in store.
Yeah. One day I'll read them.
You
one day.
You have to do it. You have to do it.
Yeah, I'm going to go through them all.
But no, it's been a great week. Yesterday I was on the Man Booker, the Cheltenham Man Booker 1958 panel, and each panelist had to champion a book that was up for the 1958 Man Booker if the Man Booker Prize had been around. And it's great that I can officially say that I won. Wow, where's my round of applause? Thank you. so I championed Achebe's 1984, Things Fall Apart. Yeah. And it was amazing.
That was such a fun
experience.
Yeah, it got really heated as well, because people were like, no.
I can imagine,
What other books were in the...
Iris Murdoch's The Bell, Graham Greene's...
Our
Man in Havana. We had Breakfast at Tiffany's by Capote, and... Oh, man... I forgot the other one. The other one, the reason why I forget, because it was knocked out like straight away.
Saturday night, Sunday
morning.
That's right. Saturday night, Sunday morning,
So that was amazing.
Amazing.
I've never been to... I've been to Cheltenham before to do shows here. And last show I did here, I did... Cheltenham Civic, is it the Everyman Theatre?
Yeah.
And I went on stage and I saw this black guy in the audience. And I was doing my show and I kept looking at him, and it was Tony. Does anybody know who Tony Ettore is? He had a hit record called "Are You Man Enough? Big and Bad Enough? Are You Man Enough?" And I said, "I'm sorry, what's your name?" He said, "You know who I am, Lenny." Sing it. How arrogant is that? And I bloody did sing it. And the audience were like, "Why is Lenny singing to this guy?" But it was a fantastic show. Yeah. So that's my other experience of Cheltenham. But this is my first time to be here in World of Tents and Books.
Mm.
And I'm loving it. I love, because I read voraciously. So to come to a place where it's all about literature and books and seeing authors explain themselves is fantastic. Plus, I'm writing a memoir, which is going to be out next year. So I just saw Simon Mayo, and we were talking about writing and the process, and it's a very rich experience being here, and I hope I get to come back next year when my book is out.
Yeah. Amazing,
fantastic,
amazing,
fantastic.
So very quickly, what's everybody reading at the moment?
At the moment,
yes,
I'm reading Martin Luther King's A Gift of Love, and yeah, I gotta say, it's amazing, I think, so far. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I'm at the point, he talks about, you know, being tender-hearted but having like a strong mind, and kind of like finding that balance. And if you find that balance, you've kind of reached a place of like genuine humanity, genuine love, genuine all these different things. It doesn't mean that you have to be like so open and like not really mindful of certain things and how you position yourself in this world. But yeah, like in obviously the way he writes as if he's making a speech, and you can hear his voice echoing and booming at you as you read it through the words. And that's what I'm reading at the minute. And I know Derek's giving me some James Baldwin stuff that I need to get through.
Before we came here, guys, you just gave me a James Baldwin book.
Yeah,
yes,
and I was like, what's this about?
Well, because if anybody doesn't know, Penguin I've now kind of reissuing the lesser known Baldwin books. So
these are the thin ones.
No, these are actually the novels that he wrote, the last novels he wrote. So Just Above My Head and Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, which are the lesser known ones. Then If Bill Street Could Talk, which is being turned into a movie. And they're just amazing. Penguin are doing a great job. Yeah, I work for Penguin, if you don't know. That's why I'm plugging the books.
Oh, it's like that.
Yeah, but
there's an agenda here.
Someone wants a promotion, you know?
Yeah, but they are literally amazing.
Are they? That's what I'm reading. There is bosses in the audience going,
yeah.
Baldwin. Tell them about Baldwin.
Right, but what are you reading there?
I'm reading, it's called Like a Thief in the Night by Slavoj Žižek. It's basically his rambling, talking about, you know, capitalism and how the failures of the left and so on and so on. As he says, and so on and so on. So, but it's because I watch a lot of videos of him where he talks, and he's so. To me, it seems like he's so intelligent that he starts one sentence and he forgets what he's talking about. Then he starts going on another thing, but then he rounds it all off and it actually makes sense.
Yeah.
So I thought, imagine what it would be like reading him. But funny enough, he's the way he writes is very clear. It's not the way he speaks. So I'm just reading that. And yeah, he's a very, very interesting guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Lenny? What are you reading?
I read several books simultaneously. So I'm reading about Francis Ford Coppola at the moment. It's a biography, but it's also a kind of a rundown of his films and the critical reaction to them. And extraordinary guy, was a kind of wunderkind when he started out, and ended up working for Roger Corman making exploitation films. Got his chance to work in his early 20s on a film called Dementia 13, which brought him into the public eye. Then he was given the opportunity to make a musical, an old school musical called Finian's Rainbow. And from that, he got to make a film called The Rain People, and it wasn't as big a success, but he did get to write a film called Patton. So not only was he a brilliant director, but he was also a highly regarded screenwriter. And this book is just this overview of his life and his career and his obsessions. And it's fascinating to read about this guy who was prepared to gamble his own money, his own soul, and his own mental state on making the films that he really, really cared about. And then when all that failed, because he started his own movie studio called Zoetrope and it failed miserably, he hired himself out as a very good director for hire, and he managed to claw his way back to solvency. And so the book is about that, and it's very, very interesting. I'm also dipping into and rereading Stephen King's On Writing, which, if you're a writer embarking on a writing career, I would say it's one of the best books about creativity there's ever been written. It's about the craft, and it's also Stephen King writing about his, in a kind of refracted way, about his upbringing and his childhood. He's a very smart writer because he sold all those books, so why wouldn't he be? But he's also very good on craft. So
we'll get into that a bit later.
I'm really enjoying that.
What am I reading? So because I had to read all these Man Booker books, because Derek was initially supposed to be on the panel, and then he was like, read them. So I had to read them in a matter of days. And I've actually just finished off Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana, and I actually loved it. I thought it was hilarious and funny.
Had you read it before?
No.
Oh.
I hadn't read it before.
Okay, what's it about?
So it's about this man called Wormald, and he lives in Cuba with his daughter Millie. His wife left him. Very boring man who sells, what is it, washing machines or hoovers?
Vacuums.
Hoovers.
Washing machine. Vacuum.
So, and then he gets approached by the MI6 to basically be a spy. Man doesn't know what he's doing before. And he just started making up these elaborate tales so that he can keep his job, so that he can get money, so that he can provide his really materialistic, devout daughter with things that she wants. And one of the things that she wants is a horse, right?
I've been there.
Yeah. and it's so weird that these elaborate tales started coming true in a way. So it was really hilarious, but it was a real, I guess, critique of Secret Service in Britain. And it was just really hilarious.
What did you think of the writing? Because I
did you like the writing?
I don't like the way Graham Greene writes.
Right.
Sometimes it feels like, to me, when he writes a sentence, there's a word that should connect the next word, but he misses it out.
I think he just makes you want. He wants you to make that assumption. So why would he put it?
No, I personally, if that's what he's trying to do, I don't think it lands very well. So I've tried to read two of his books.
Can critique that on writing.
The Power and the Glory, yeah. I tried to read that. Yeah. I couldn't get on with that.
What would Stephen King say about his writing? That would be quite interesting.
That would be interesting, yeah.
But yes, that's what I read. And it's so weird because on the panel, I went to the guy defending it. I said, I love this book. And if I wasn't defending Achebe, I'd defend your book. And I went up on stage and I was like, the book is horrible. Yeah, let's take it out.
Really?
And he just looked at me like, oh, and I was like, I have to be strategic.
The game is the game. Yeah, exactly.
So, that's what I'm reading.
Right, so, okay. So the book we chose for this episode was On Writing by Stephen King. Uh-huh. So that's, it's a memoir. So he has a lot of his backstory throughout the book, but he also has really salient tips on how to write well and the kind of tools that he uses to write well. But first of all, what do you guys think about the book?
I want to ask Lenny, why did you pick the book?
I've been doing a screenwriting PhD for the last 6.5 years.
Okay.
And one of the things I've been fascinated by is this industry that sprung up in the last 25 years about the act, the art, the craft of writing. So, you know, I would imagine that William Goldman, who wrote Adventures in the Screen Trade, is probably the person that started this idea of you can study screenwriting as a thing. You can look at it, you know, here's how you write a script, here's how you write a scene, you get in late and you get out early. You know, William Goldman started to ascribe these little aphorisms and rules about screenwriting and ideas about how to make your screenplay tight and what it should look like on the page and how characters work and how scenarios work and all that kind of stuff. And then there have been other books like Screenwriting and Screenplay and Save the Cat by Blake Snyder. And they're all books that tell you how to write and give you a kind of cake recipe. You start at page 30, there should be an inciting incident. About 60 pages in, there should be a midpoint. There's all these rules about screenwriting. And I'm fascinated by it because I'm a creative and I write, and it feels to me like every writer you talk to says, don't read those books.
Yeah,
they don't work, they're rubbish.
Yeah.
There's no hard and fast rule book about how to write a screenplay or how to write a novel. You've just got to put the work in and then work with somebody who, an editor or somebody that cares about you, to help you edit and craft and shape your book. But actually, by reading the methodologies of people like Stephen King or Flaubert, or when you read about how these people write, you do get a sense of actually there is a kind of a, maybe there is a system of how to sit down and craft something. Maybe it would be good to read these people and learn from them. And, you know, we say we stand on the shoulders of giants. Why wouldn't you read the Stephen King book On Writing? Stephen King sold millions of books. So I started to dip into it over the last 6.5, 7 years. And it's taught me a lot about short story writing, about memoir writing. He tends to write, when he writes about himself, he quotes a writer, and I can't remember her name, but he quotes this writer, and he says that she writes with pin-sharp accuracy about her past. But when he writes, it's like he's writing through a gauzy curtain. It's like he's taking snapshots of his life rather than trying to tell you chapter and verse with pin-sharp accuracy, because his memory doesn't work like that. And I like that kind of way. When I'm writing memoir now, and I'm writing the things I can remember. I'm not going around talking to lots of people and trying to get 100 people to tell me exactly what my childhood was like. Because I think that if you remember it, write it down, and that's what you remember.
Yeah.
But if you go out and seek everybody's chapter and verse about your upbringing, A, maybe they're wrong, and B, maybe it's dull.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's better to remember the things that stand out with that firework accuracy and get that down. And then when you read it, you think, actually, this is quite good. So,
yeah.
So it's best to do that.
Yeah.
But Stephen King's thing I love is about the craft element of the writing,
yeah.
The toolbox.
I love that bit.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I won't go into detail, but it's basically the the Strunken White. Is it Strunken White? It's the grammar stuff.
Yeah.
It's the toolbox of
so nuts and bolts.
How you shape sentences and why paragraphs are the way they are. And the thing about the overuse of adverbs and you've got to get rid of them. And
he said the road to hell is paved with
adverbs. Yeah. It's that stuff. And it's just nuts and bolts, and it's really handy, and I'd recommend it to anybody interested in writing. I'd highly recommend it.
Now, because you said you're a creative, when you was writing your memoir, did you ever remember something and think, this is a bit dull, let me just embellish it a little bit?
I think that's your job. Absolutely, make it better or funnier or whatever. Yeah. Everybody remembers things in a different way. Mm. And what I think people tend to do is go, well, it didn't happen like this, but I'm going
to spice it up.
I'm going to spice it up a bit. Either in description or in characterization, you make it more exciting than it was, because who wants to hear the boring stuff, you know? You absolutely sharpen it.
But that's life, isn't it? Life is boring sometimes. Sometimes you have to go through, like, I remember Bertrand Russell basically saying that when you read a novel and it becomes boring, you have to just carry on reading the boring stuff, because that's what life is. Life isn't interesting.
Stephen King would say, cut that bit out.
Yeah.
Because your novel is like real life, but with the boring bits cut out. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, I've read something, you know, some guys write memoirs like that, and you're ploughing through them and you've got electrodes attached to your genitals shocking you awake every 20 minutes. But, you know, it's possible to read, you know, the Viv Albertine memoir is fantastically salacious and gossip filled and a really fast read. You read it like that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there are some, the George Best memoir is the same. There are some where you just go, I can't wait to get to the end of it. You know, and then when you're 50 pages from the end, you don't want it to finish.
Yeah.
So I want my memoir to be like that. I want it to be exciting and event filled and sharp and funny. You know, I would hate to burden the reader with a thing of where they feel like they've got to get through it. And Stephen King's, when you read On Writing, it's real short.
Yeah.
And it's got so much in it. And what a cool thing to leave behind, a short book about craft, a short essay on his memoirs, and then boom, let's get on with it. And then he had a short story competition with a winner, and he prints the winner at the back of the book. It's great.
I wanted to ask, so in the book he talks about this toolbox, and when he was going through it, I realised things that I did in my writing, and I was like, oh crap, I need to stop that. When you were writing your memoir, did you have a point where you were like, oh, Stephen King has talked about this, maybe I should pull back on it? What was the thing that he would have said, no Lenny, that's crap, take it out?
I think the good thing that he says is write for yourself first. So you write with the door closed, and then when you've got to the end, you open the door and then everybody comes in. And he writes for his wife, Tabitha. So Tabitha King reads every first draft of every Stephen King book. And my partner, Lisa, reads everything I write. And I've got a friend who's a literary editor, that's lucky, who also reads things that I write and just says, and I've got a couple of other people. So it's quite good to have, he has this thing called Ideal Reader. And I think that's a really good practice. Just to have somebody who just goes, yeah, that's cool, or I'm a bit worried about the bit in the middle, or do you really want this out there in the world? For instance, if you're writing about your family, do you want to say that about your dad? Do you want to say that about your mom? Maybe you should think about revising that. So it's quite good to have a few people from different backgrounds, you know, they're like you, like if it's me, they're black, or they're in the business, or they're a friend who has no axe to grind. You know, you don't want somebody who might be jealous of you, or who has a secret beef with you, you know, because they're going to say something mean that crushes you, that means you can't write. And you don't want that. You only want people in your ideal reader group who are going to encourage you and push you forward in your writing. So I've tried to assemble a little squad like that, and it's really helped me.
Because he does talk about actually getting people who are going to read your work and read it and actual criticise and actually give you like constructive feedback with it, not just ones that will glance over it and be like, oh, this is fine, just
well
to say
done.
Your friends.
You don't want that.
You know what I mean? They're going to go in and say, well, this could be different, this could
but he's also got experts. He's got police guys who know about guns and about procedure. He's got hospital people who know about medical stuff. So it's within your wheelhouse to cultivate people who can help you when you need to know serious stuff and you need it fact checked. But it's research, you know, it's part of the research. Yeah. And he also talks about writing on drugs, which is very handy, I think. The idea of writing drunk or writing high. Mm. And then he talks about the thing of when you stop, the feeling of, can I write sober, which is a massive part of his life, you know. His family had an intervention to stop him taking drugs, and then once he did that, and a lot of the books he talked about when he was high, they're fantastic books. And you think, oh my god, he wrote Carrie and he wrote Cujo and the Tommyknockers when he was off his tits, you know. And it's, that's crazy. So now when he's sober, you know, he's having to, I mean, he's got this massive inner critic saying, yeah, we should get high because this is slow, Steve. And that's tough to get through, I think.
What I like about that is he actually mentioned how there's this cultivated aesthetic that the creative is this guy who gets drunk at night each time. And he was like, actually, you're not like a writer. You're just drunk right now. And he kind of dispelled the idea that for you to be creative, you have to take drugs and you have to do all of these other things to fit the image of the creator. I think he did that really well. He was just like, actually, no, mate, you need to stop doing this. Because he even said that he forgot some things when he wrote them.
It's like, easy for him to say when he's written best-selling books off his tits. Do you know what I mean?
Some of the most best-selling books of all time.
Yeah.
It's easy for him to say that.
Yeah.
And I guess lots of creatives think, well, I got to drink. I got to get high.
Yeah. To be able to produce
work like that. And it's a thing, isn't it, with creatives of, you know, I've got to go out and I've got to get drunk because Hemingway did that, you know. And I think that the courageous thing is to just sit there with yourself and with your cup of tea and or your water or your coffee and just go, I'm going to do this.
What can I do whilst just being me and not under influence?
And dig deep and just try and find that feeling that you have when you're drinking.
But it's the hard thing to...
It is hard.
This is the hard yards you got to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you're a writer. It's that thing of sitting with yourself. And they call it, you know, gluing your bum to the seat. It's tenacity. And it's sitting there and it's just writing, good or bad. You have a bad day, you have a good day, but you try and get to the end. You try and get your 500 pages done, and then you see. You see what it is.
How do you deal with like the criticism and rejection and the like? Just because when you're writing something, like we've all been through this, like we've written something and we've guarded it and we thought, I don't really want to have to share it with like Derek, I don't want to share it with Ray, just because I don't know,
they might say something,
you know what I mean? Like how do you kind of overcome that bit? Is it something that is just like, well, just,
I think the first thing is be proud that you finished something, because lots of people start things and don't finish them. So the first thing is be really proud of yourself. The criticism is going to come whenever happens, and I think you wrote it, you must have wanted people to read it, so you've got to take it on the chin when it comes. And also take the brilliant thing about that book is that Stephen King talks about the rejection slips. He had a big spike in his office, and every rejection he got, he would just put a rejection on a spike, he would carry on. And I think that eventually people start to say, not for us, but well done. Try and think about this. And they'd start giving him little tips. And then eventually somebody would go, yeah, this is a good story, we'll have this. But it took him a long time. And what you think when you read these sections from On Writing is, my God, if Stephen King went through all this rejection, maybe I could.
Yeah.
Maybe I could. It encourages you to write. Because he went through hell trying to get his things away. And of course, in those days when he was writing, you had all these outlets for short stories. Now there's not so many. I think it's different now because you can go online and you can upload your stories. But back in the day, you were sending things to Knave and Playboy and Penthouse trying to get your stuff published. And there were also short story outlets too. But it's different now. I think you have to be very, very tough and develop a thick skin when you're writing.
Yes.
Because you know what? Not everybody's going to like everything you do. So you've got to get used to that. Because even your family, this isn't as good as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Even your family are going to have beef with stuff you write. So you've got to be careful. And you've got to have your creativity close to your heart, because there's going to be some stray comment from somebody that you know and love that might make you go, oh, well, I shouldn't write.
Yeah.
You've got to protect yourself from that stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Stephen King, because he was sending stuff out and putting things on his rejection spike, he could kind of go, oh, I'm just going to carry on. But that takes a lot of doing.
Yeah.
surround yourself with people who are going to support you and make sure you carry on.
Yeah. So speaking of like developing thick skin, you know, Stephen King calls editors the divine. Now, whenever I've written something and I've sent it through to like my agent or an editor and they've come back with critiques, my first thing is like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I come like, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Do you, idiot.
I like, I'm thinking, I know why, bro. This is why. You just don't get it. Yeah. Now, do you ever feel like that when you get the edits back and you're just like, oh my god, like, am I a shit writer? And my editor's just trying to turn me into a decent one.
I'm working at Faber and Faber at the moment, and I wanted to work there because Siegfried Sassoon and Derek Walcott and people like that, you know, Siegfried Sassoon is still in print and it just smells like they know what they're doing. And when you're in a place like that, you just, the editors are so smart. You've got, the fact is they've invited you to write for them. So I tend to listen to what my editor says, because I just think, well, you're really smart and you know what you're doing, and it's a collaboration in the end. I think that if you're on the other end of that, if you're asking to be admitted into, if you're asking for a writing deal, then take it on the chin if people give you criticisms, because you're asking to be admitted into the Hall of Fame. You want to be one of their published writers. So it stands to reason that they're going to have things to say about your writing. They're giving up their time to comment. It's like when Stephen King said, oh yeah, and they started to write things. There was a form letter, and then they would write in their own handwriting little notes. And once they started to write little notes in their own handwriting, you start to think, oh, they're getting engaged in my work. They're starting to connect with my work. They're not there yet, but, you know, but once you've been signed, then I think you've got to accept what people... It's fine to have the debate about it, but they know what they're doing, and you should allow them to have a say in what you're doing, because they want to get it over the line as much as you do.
So what were some of the difficult bits to overcome when doing the memoir? Because there's always that one memory that you think, I don't really want to have to go there, but I might have to go there for the sake of...
I'm on my fourth or fifth draft now, and I handed the fifth draft in a couple of weeks ago, and it was a really good feeling. It was like handing in the PhD, but it was really kind of, phew, I've done that. But now the tough thing is waiting for the comments. He wants a month to read it all and to make notes. He's not gonna do type notes, he's going to do handwritten notes in the text. He's going to sit and talk with me for a whole day about it. I've never written a book like this before, so this is all first time experience. I'm looking forward to it, but I'm also dreading it.
Yeah.
Because it's a long manuscript. I know there's going to be cuts. And he's going to have an opinion about it. And I have to allow it. I have to allow his opinion, because I want the book to be good and I want to get it across the finish line. So I will accept cuts and I will accept rewrites, because I want it to be as good as he wants it to be. But it's tough to take people's criticisms. You have to develop a thick skin. You have to not suck your teeth when they say things about your work. you have to be on the train. So I'm going to get on the train and do the work. So I reckon I've got more work to do. I'm sure there's another couple of drafts. It might never end until publishing. You know, I might still be there just before publishing going, but I'm sure there's going to be at least another two drafts of things, some fixing, some messing around. And I'm looking forward to it, actually. I love it. I've loved it. And there's things about your, you know, when you're writing a memoir, just some tips, it's really good to tell your family about stuff, because they might not want their business chatted out in the open for everybody to read. I had a thing when I did Danny in the Human Zoo where I talked about my upbringing and my parents and stuff, and I told stories about my parents, and my siblings had a real problem with it, and I had to deal with that after the piece had come out. And we're very private people. My family are very private and working class, and they had an issue with me writing a film script about our family. It was like you've divulged family secrets, and you didn't. By the way, I sent them all a script, and they all read it, or they told me they'd all read it. But when they watched it on television, they went, oh, we didn't know you were going to talk about this. You're chatting the family business. So I had to sit down with everybody and say, look, you know, you all read the script. You all told me you'd read it. Yeah. And I told you what was going to happen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And you told me it was all right. And now you're saying it's not all right. And they had the press show up on their doorsteps and people bothering them at work and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was a really tough time to get through. But with this, I'm sending the next manuscript to all my siblings, and they've all got to read it, and they've all got to approve it before I go to the next stage.
Yeah.
And that's a really big thing.
What do you want after, like, once you've reached that finish line and it comes out, what is it that you want each reader coming to the memoir? What do you want them to leave thinking or feeling, or what effect do you want this memoir to have in the world?
I love books. And I love getting lost in somebody else's story. I read a lot of memoirs, and I'm interested in the persnickety detail that people bring to telling the story of their life. I'm interested in obstacles, how people overcome things. Mm. You hit a glass wall or a glass ceiling, and, you know, particularly when you're a person of colour, you know, the story of how you overcame Long Walk to Freedom, Mandela, you know, these stories are important, and they are, you know, the Martin Luther King story, you're talking Malcolm X biography, the thing of overcoming a jail sentence or enduring an assassination attempt or going through a religious change in life or whatever. These things are important and fascinating to read about. And I would like it if people got lost in my story and didn't want it to end, because these are my favourite books. You know, you get to the end, like, you get to the kind of three quarters of the way through Dombey and Son, and you don't want it to end. Or, you know, one of the best Stephen King books is The Stand.
Yeah.
And I kept getting a third of the way through and then stopping and rereading from the beginning because I didn't want it to finish. Or, you know, Things Fall Apart,
yeah,
or White Teeth, mm-hmm, or something. You read these books, or On Beauty by Zadie Smith. Oh, my God. Yeah. You get about halfway through and go, I love this book.
Yeah.
I don't want it to end. I want that for my book.
Yeah.
And it might be that people go, yeah, I read a bit of it. It was all right. But I'm going to keep writing until people do that. I'm not going to give up.
Yeah.
Okay. I want you to just kind of compare writing jokes and comedy sketches to the writing process of writing a memoir. So, for example, in my mind, I always think of F. Scott Fitzgerald when he wrote The Great Gatsby. The last few lines, he must have wrote those and thought, this is the shit. Do you ever, because, and when you're writing a joke,
just drop the pen.
Yeah, just drop the mic drop, exactly.
This is
it. When you're writing a joke, in your head, you must think, this is funny. When you was writing the memoir, did you ever write like a paragraph or a few lines and think, this is good shit?
Well, certainly in the first instance with a joke, what's great about writing jokes is you rarely... There's only people like Victoria Wood or Ben Elton that write jokes on their own. I think Ramesh Ranganathan writes everything and then sits in a room for a couple of days with another writer. Yeah. But most people who do comedy sit in a group like this, mm. and they go, what about this? What about that? And then if people laugh, that's the joke that goes on the page.
Okay.
Generally, when you're writing a memoir or a novel or something, you're on your own in a room eating hobnobs and watching blockbusters on the telly and hoping that you get struck by inspiration. And I think, yeah, there's a great bit in Coldwater Farm. Is that the name of the book?
Cold Comfort Farm.
Cold Comfort Farm, where, is it Stella Gibbons?
Yeah.
She puts an asterisk next to a couple of paragraphs, and I think it's the equivalent of, this is really good writing. this shit is deep.
Yeah.
But she puts an asterisk by her favourite passages, and I don't do that, but I know... If I'm smiling when I'm writing, I'm enjoying the writing process, and I know it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
I know it's funny. But if it's a grind, I kind of know that, oh, I might have to go through this with the editor because this bit was difficult.
Yeah. Right.
But jokes is jokes, and usually you know if a joke is funny.
Yeah.
I usually know when something's going to bring down the house, just because it's just the surprise of it or the percussive nature of the way you've written it. But with writing, I like Annie Proulx, you know, who wrote Brokeback Mountain and The Shipping Forecast, and she writes sentences like she's cracking a whip. Yeah. You know, it's like the sentences crackle with energy and they're beautifully written. And you know, you just think, you read it and you just go, I'm never going to write like this. So you just got to write the best you can. You've got to be you.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, I've read all these books, I love all these people, but I've just got to write like me now.
Yeah.
I'm not Maya Angelou, I'm me. Yeah. So the thing to do is write like you. And
I
then
get that a lot.
Let somebody else pick the bones out of it.
Yeah.
I'll read Oscar Wilde just before I start writing because I'm like, I need that energy to come to me.
Oscar Wilde energy.
Yeah. I love a good Oscar Wilde.
Good
man.
Luck.
Yeah.
Good luck. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what I wanted to ask you is, Stephen King talks about how don't watch television, right?
Get off your phones.
Get off
people.
Your phones. However, I recently watched Wildish Gambino. Your video where you talk about...
This is the TV.
This is the TV.
Yeah.
Okay. And obviously it's based off of Childish Gambino's This Is America video. And my thing is, This Is The TV was quite... To me, it was quite like, oh man, remember when we used to sit down with the whole family and watch television?
Yeah.
And now kids are just on their phones. But how would you justify that to Stephen King, who says, get off the television and actually write?
Stephen King is a person of a certain age. That's the first thing I'd say. I think there's so much inspirational stuff going on television. You've got to be judicious and pick carefully. But, you know, Breaking Bad, Sopranos, you can't... The Wire.
The Wire,
you can't discount these things. And they're culturally significant. You've got to watch these things.
Yeah.
The Wire is the most black people in a drama created by white people I've ever seen. And they've written it with some accuracy, and they've worked within the community. You know, these guys are journalists and policemen, and they've tried to apply their knowledge of police procedural and journalistic writing to the problems and issues of the black community in a place with the highest murder rate in America. And they've come out with something that is culturally significant. Why wouldn't you watch that? Breaking Bad, same. Sopranos, the same. So I think that, you know, in this day and age, people will binge watch things and catch up. People don't watch television the way they used to.
Yeah.
Television's changed, and This Is The TV was about the way television has changed and the fact that we need to move the needle along in the conversation about why aren't we more inclusive with our television? Yeah. Why aren't there more black people and brown people on television, more women on television? When is that going to change? Apart from Doctor Who, I watch telly, and I still feel like it's tokenistic when I watch television.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. And it's because behind the scenes there aren't enough people making decisions about what we watch. There aren't enough people of colour, there aren't enough women, there aren't enough gay people, there aren't enough people of alternate gender or alternate religion. It's just very much the patriarchy. It's pale, male, stale and white. It's dominant culture. That's who's in charge.
Yeah.
And until that changes even a little bit, television is going to remain the same as it's always been.
Yeah.
What's been great in the last few years while we've been campaigning about this stuff is that it's moved along a little bit, so that the conversation has changed. In publishing, it's worse. Mm-hmm. In publishing, it's really bad behind the scenes. Yeah. Editors and publishers and the guys who get to choose who writes what, you know, there's a black section, there's an African section, yeah, there's a ghetto section, but there's no general thing of, yeah, come on, let's all do something.
Yeah.
I found this kid who's a brilliant writer and who's born in Britain and he's black, but he's not, but he writes like F. Scott Fitzgerald, or he writes like, there's none of that. You're in a genre or you're in a niche and you stay there. So you got Black Writers Workshop, you got African Writers Workshop, or you got the Jamaican, the Afro-Caribbean writers. There isn't a sense of eating at the big table. And until we get black and brown editors and publishers and thinkers and creatives, you're not going to get that change. So that's the thing to fight for. And that's what we're fighting for in the television and film industry. And these are transferable things, you know. When you look at what's happening in the city and in banks, they're very aware that they need to be diverse and representative because they do business with the world. You know, they are global businesses. So I think publishing and television and film are global businesses too.
Yeah.
And so they need to catch up. They need to catch up.
Yeah.
Because banks and insurance and things are leaving the creative industries behind, and that's mental.
I guess that corporate side is more so thinking there's a market here for people who are not straight males, essentially. But in the publishing world, the marketing for, I guess, black people is, well, let's tell them the black struggle story. Maybe that's what they're into. Maybe if we could get a nice another slave book, they'll buy that. But if it's just any other book,
give a slave.
Maybe they won't. And I think what,
give them another slave book, they'll buy that. Those black readers.
So I guess is your take that there should be a change from inside the infrastructure rather than just putting out another black story?
Infrastructure is everything, because once you have, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So if you're an author and you walk into a meeting and you're the only person of color in the room, you're sitting there going, okay, fine. And what I find with creativity and going into a room that is predominantly white is that you're always in an act of translation or interpretation. So you're always having to explain yourself as a writer, and nobody says to white writers, this is another white story. Nobody says that. Whereas with black writers, if you're writing a story about coming from the ends, or if you're writing a slavery story, or if you're writing a Windrush story, you know,
I've got another one for that, don't worry.
It's sort of like you get pushed into that niche because that's what they expect. But you know what did I read the other day? I read an extraordinary book called My Darling Something, about a survivalist with a daughter, and it's an incredibly abusive relationship, and it was, I can't imagine that being a black writer, because they just don't expect us to write stories like that. So I think that within the publishing industry, you know, the more you open up who's behind the scene as the publishers, the writers, the owners, the more these areas are opened out, they will get the chance to find people who aren't just writing that particular race-specific story. You will get stories about survivalists and bartenders and, you know, as Rinzi Kane says in his play Misty, stories about rom-coms where couples ride a bike through the park in the sunshine. Why can't I have a book about riding a book in the sunshine? Where's my rom-com? You know, and the fact of the matter is, Mike Gale is writing rom-coms, but at the moment, nobody's picking them up, nobody's adapting them to make them into movies, because it's perceived that there isn't an interest. You know, who's going to watch that? And I think there's a big audience for that. Why wouldn't you watch that? In America, you know, you get Waiting to Exhale and Brown Sugar, and there's an audience for that. But it feels like not enough interest has been shown in those stories in Britain.
They're still not respected, though, like Brown Sugar and those kind of black rom-coms as well, because they're not kind of pitted a lot. They're kind of not distributed to like many like cinemas as well. They're kind of like put into smaller ones. So they're
Somebody's watching them, because Tyler Perry has his own jet.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Somebody's watching these movies. So I think that you could have a similar, you know, there is a big appetite, I think, for Look at you guys, you're a black podcast. There's a big appetite for alternate entertainment.
Yeah.
There's a big appetite for multicultural entertainment. People are interested in cultural, whatever they tell you, people are interested in cultural exchange. Mm. You know, look at you guys. Look at If Beale Street Could Talk. Look at Moonlight. Mm. You know, Ava DuVernay. You know, Lee Daniels. I loved Moonlight. I watched it in Brooklyn. It was a mostly white audience, loving it, giving it a standing ovation at the end. We are interested in each other's story. We grow up within communities. We observe each other. We learn about each other. Mm. And I think that Tunde Ikoli was asked, how come you're so good at writing white people? And Tunde said, I grew up with white people. Why wouldn't I know how to write white people? They're my friends, my family, whatever. You know, we live in a world where we are observing each other and culturally exchanging everything all the time. We know about stuff and allow us the privilege of showing you how cool we are, showing you how good we are, showing you that we're as good as anybody else. That's all we want. And I'm, you know, when I see that Mallory Blackman is going to write on Doctor Who, I think, wow, we're getting there. We're getting somewhere. That's great. Now we just have to get some people writing on Endeavour and Open All Hours or something. Let's change that.
Oh God!
Let's change that. Let's have some brothers in. More brothers. They never know how to write the black family in EastEnders.
Oh my God!
Black people are always vexed. EastEnders is on. Oh God! We never know what to say about it. I'm making a cup of tea. Do you want a cup of tea? Get out of my house. Get out of my pub. But we can do that. We can write that. We can write Get Out My Pub. For years, Coronation Street was the only street where there was a corner shop with no black people in it. I was like, it was the only street in England where there was no Indian people running it. I was like, where's the Indian guy? They changed it recently, but it was for a long time. But, you know, things are changing. And, you know, as my friend Marcus Ryder said repeatedly, you know, you keep saying wait and see. Well, I've waited and I'm seeing. You know, when is it going to change? And it's going to change when the infrastructure changes, and that's what you're fighting for.
So obviously you've been in the industry for a very, very long time, and we once did a podcast with Mallory Blackman, and she basically said that the kind of the how diversity is now trending, she said she's seen it before, so she's not getting excited about it this time. She just feels like, okay, diversity is trending again, blah blah blah, it's gonna go away, then in what, 5-10 more years, it's gonna come back again. But then other people have said this time it feels a bit different. I mean, I wanted to ask, how do you feel about it?
Since being signed to write a memoir for Faber and Faber, I've had lots of letters and digital conversations about publishing and the lack of diversity within publishing. And recently there was some data. We live in a world of big data. And somebody sent this, somebody in the publishing industry did some research about BAME, blacks, Asians, minority ethnics in the world of publishing. And the results were shocking. Similarly, in the world of television and film, there's a thing called Directors UK, where this new information has come out where like 3% of the directors in the TV and film industry are people of disgraceful. 3%, 0% in shiny floor television shows, like minimal percentage in dramas. I mean, in high-end dramas, none. And in all these other transferable industries, people are doing, it seems like people really respect the numbers. They really respect statistics. You know, between 2012 and 2015, we found via skill set that some people did a research and they did a snapshot of the industry, and something like 39% of black, Asian, minority, ethnic people had left the industry. Where for every one black person that left the industry, two white people were employed in the film and television industry. And if 15% of the nation is BAME, 40% of London is BAME, and most of the industry is in London. So that's, these figures are terrible. So it was like a real wake-up call for the entire industry. So since then, since the activism started, The BFI now have a system, a three-tick system, whereby you have to tick all three things in order to get your film made. So either by subject matter or director or cast, two of those have to be diverse, otherwise you're not going to get your movie made. Stuart Murphy came to when he was in charge of Sky Television, came to a meeting at BAFTA and heard all these vexed people talking about the lack of representation in the TV and film industry. And he went back to Sky and said, we're going to have targets. 20% of writers, 20% producers, 20% everything, and we're going to try and fulfill these by 2020. And it's been difficult. Quotas are easy. Quotas, you can get the guy from IT, the one of the cleaning ladies and a dinner lady, and you can say, look, we fulfilled our quota. We got the guy from IT and the car park guy. But with targets, you've got to have the real people, otherwise it doesn't work. So Sky are trying to do that. Channel 4 did this 360 thing, which is like a 4-foot thick guideline of what they've got to try and achieve with diversity in the next 5 years. People are talking about it. People are trying to do it. And as long as people are talking about it, I'm happy. Hmm. We need, like, Black Lives Matter, like, you know, hashtag Me Too, the Pussy Riot thing. We're all talking about these things that are affecting us and that are making us angry. And it's good. Vomit it out. Get it out there. Nothing changes without conversation. Nothing changes without people going, do you know what? I'm pissed off about this and I'm going to say something. I'm going to be brave enough to say something. Mm. People are opening their mouth and they're publishing online. Mm. They're bypassing editors. Yeah. They're bypassing publishing houses or television stations. You don't have to go and audition anymore. You can just go, I think this about this subject. Mm. And I'm going to make a podcast. Boom. Yeah. So while young people are doing that, while people are just uploading things and saying what's on their mind, while we're taking the advantage of this multi-platform world we're living in, I think be activist, be loud, be annoying. Because as it said in Sylvia, which is a musical about Emmeline Pankhurst, nobody takes any notice of the dutiful person. They take notice of the noisy person who's always moaning. So be the person that's always moaning and making themselves heard, because eventually they've got to listen to you.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, I guess it's a good time for questions, if anybody has some questions they want to ask us or ask Lenny.
Ah, the lights are on!
Is this...
Oh, we've got a question right in the middle, yeah?
Yeah, there.
Hi.
The mic's coming.
Mic's coming to you. Do the first 16 bars of Eric B for President and I will literally buy you a drink. I'm just joking. Carry on.
It's very interesting to hear actors writing memoirs. We've just come from Sally Field, who's written her own memoir
as
well.
You like me? You really like me?
Well, and she talked about she would reenact her childhood. That's how she sort of brought things back that she didn't remember. You've talked about sort of just talking about the things that you do remember. I wanted to ask you a question. Why are you writing it? Is it cathartic? Are you writing it for you? Or are you writing it for us?
I think, as with all the best things, if you start off writing it for you and you find it interesting, hopefully people reading it will find it interesting too. It was the right time, I think. I was hitting a big birthday, and it's sort of like, I think your past can be a bit of a burden, you know, if things happen to you when you're growing up that you're still carrying around as hurts and slights, you can literally exercise demons by, even if you just keep a journal, by vomiting it out, you can make yourself feel better about things. And I grew up in interesting times. There was racism. You know, I'm writing about times when in Smethwick, a guy got voted in under the banner, if you want a nigger for a neighbour, vote Labour. In 60, whenever it was, Enoch Powell had just made a speech about there being rivers of blood and prophesying that the black man will hold the whip hand over the, you know, there were times when my brother used to walk past walls that said "Keep Britain White." When my mother arrived in the mid 1950s, there were signs in windows, in every window, that said "No blacks, no Irish, no dogs." My mum would walk down a street and people would ask her where her tail was. So I carry that. So for me to write a book about this period of my life, and the first book, which is called Who Am I Again, is about my mum's life and leads up to me winning New Faces and shortly after that. Mm. And it's been a huge exhumation of the past. And I hope people find it interesting. To me, it's a kind of... it's like a long windrush, you know? There's somebody, I think Hobsbawm wrote about the long 50s or the long 40s, the long shadow that an era casts. And for me, windrush casts a long shadow. Mm. My mom arrived 10 years later, and she experienced not everything that the windrush people experienced, but she experienced a lot. You know, there were riots in Dudley because of racism and race riots and stuff. So she lived through all of that. My brothers experienced racism and had fights on the street with teddy boys when they arrived. You know, when I was at school, I had a fight nearly every day with some guy who would call me a racist name as I walked into school. So to write about these things, it's almost like you're breathing out at last. You're exhaling. You're going, oh, whew, I got rid of that bit of poison there. And the great thing is that with hindsight, you can have a bit of a sense of humor about this stuff. So I can write around it. I can have an opinion about it that's not po-faced, that's not depressed. I can be funny about it whilst writing about something terrible. And somebody once said, comedy is tragedy, but with tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I think that's true. You can look back and go, wasn't so bad. Even if it was awful.
Perfect.
Any more questions? Yeah. Oh, that's two here.
Bit of a personal question, so I don't know if you want to answer it, but I've always wondered whether you've ever had any, as a psychotherapist, whether you've ever had any counselling or to process all that. That's what I've always wondered, really, because you're very into what happened in your childhood and it's had such an impact. And I'm just wondering if there's ever been a time that you've gone and dealt, you know, spoken about that personally. Yeah. You might not want to say that.
I think everybody has had therapy, haven't they? Huh?
Not in Cheltenham.
The unexamined life. I'd rather not know about that, actually. Yeah. I'm from Cheltenham. We don't do things like that here. Yeah. I mean, interestingly, growing up in the Midlands, particularly if you're black and working class, it's not particularly a thing that people don't talk about their, you know, your mates just kind of go, just have a drink and, you know. But when my mum passed away, I was really affected by it and I needed to offload. So I did go and see a grief counsellor for a very long time. I saw somebody for 2 years and talked to somebody for... I talked to somebody for twice a week because it was just something I found hard to quantify. My mum was like, I didn't realise it, but she was so important to me. But it was like somebody had pulled this cosmic carpet from beneath my feet. Mm. And I felt like I was free-falling. Mm. But by the way, while this was happening, I was working, I was doing stuff. And it's amazing, you know, you can get through an awful amount. I didn't let it crush me. And our family are very tight. So we were able to lean on each other and depend on each other and talk to each other. But I was able to get through a terrible time with therapy, but also with my family. Mm. We were very, very tight and we talked to each other all the time about it. So it was a mixture of the two things, really.
And I just one more question.
You're not allowed any more questions.
I wonder whether you have a favourite quote from your books.
From my book?
Well, from a book that you've read.
It's a tough question.
That's a tough question. Mm. There's so many. There's too many, really. Goethe talks about there being Goethe. It looks like Goethe. It looks like Goethe on the page, but I think you say Goethe or Goethe. Let's call the whole thing off. Tomato, tomato. It talks about there being magic in the act of creation. Mm. And I think he's right. But I think there's magic in finishing things. And I never used to finish anything. So in the spirit of Goethe, I'm going to say that there is magic in in the act of creation, but there's also magic in getting to the end. Because if you don't get to the end, how do you know what you got? Mm. So I'm going to say, you look at that quote. It's online. Everybody says it. But this act, the act of creation is magical. But I think the act of finishing something is even more magical. Mm. Because now you've got something to, now you've got some currency. Now you can show your friends and your family and go, I wrote that. Mm. Or I made this song. Or I wrote this movie. Have a read. Tell me what you think. I hate you. What are you trying to crush me for? Mm. But at least you finished it.
Mm. Yeah.
Because there's plenty of people who got halfway through and went, nah. Yeah. There's plenty of people who were talking big and then never went on stage and did 10 minutes at the Comedy Store. Couldn't get, you know, said they were going to do the open mic and then bottled it at the last minute. Mm. But imagine actually doing that open mic and doing 5 minutes and they clapped, or, you know, two of the jokes went really well, or your short story got published and somebody said a nice thing.
Yeah.
You know, this is important. So you got to do that. You got to believe in yourself. And I think any way you can do that, if you need therapy or you can talk to a best mate, anybody who'll give you some support, do that. That's what you got to do.
Mm. Cool. So we have time for one more question.
One more question, then I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Someone pick.
So you all read books a lot. Do you have any tips on how to get through the amount of books that you all read?
What do you do?
Tips?
Boy,
how many books do you read a week?
Thank you. I have to read around 2 to 3.
A week?
You read 2 to 3 books a week?
I have to, because if I'm at work, because I work on the books pages, so I have to try and get through, like...
But you're not reading them cover to cover.
You're scanning it.
I have to get through that. Okay. Then we've got one for the show.
Yes.
And I try to read one for myself.
But how do you do it?
I try to give myself deadlines. I try to say I want to try and read it between now and then. Yeah. And then I try
to go
through
it.
Good job
now,
yeah. Yeah, it's just become that.
What do you do?
What I used to do, actually, when I was at university, and I used to have work at 12 o'clock and I'd finish at 5. So I used to wake up at 9, say I'm going to read 40 pages until 10. Then I'll get ready, go to work. And as soon as I get home from work, then I'll read another 40 pages. And then that would be...
That sounds organized.
That would be my cycle, yeah. And
you can plow through it.
Yeah, you can plow through the books like that, yeah.
Get up earlier.
Get up earlier and read for an hour. But also what I would say is buy novellas and read those because they still count. You could say I've read 3 books this week. Even if they were 70 pages long, you know, it still counts.
Right. I would also say make sure that carry a book everywhere you go and find those little tiny opportunities. They could be waiting for an Uber or like just before you're going to eat or you're waiting for some Netflix show to load or some other show
Stephen King has a book everywhere with him. Yeah. It's probably one of the reasons he got run over by a car.
This is what I was saying. I put my phone away.
He wasn't looking where he was going.
Yeah.
I put my phone away the other day and I was walking down, I was looking around, everybody has their phones and I'm walking with my book in my hand, so I'm like trying to navigate. Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of the same.
But why are you doing that? Why are you walking down the road?
Because I'm trying to finish the book because I need to finish it at a particular time.
That's a damn shame.
Also, make sure, so like, I normally carry just one book, but then I remember Derek used to carry quite a few books with you, and I'm like, okay, maybe I need to carry a few books because like maybe that would help me. But actually, that just makes me even more indecisive because I'm like, okay, I have 3 books. Which one do I choose? But be very disciplined because sometimes you're not in the mood to read it. But it depends on how you want to read, whether you want to be able to say I finished this book or you just need to be in the mood.
Have you got Kindle on your phone?
Get Kindle on your phone.
Yeah.
It's great. You read much more than you thought you were going to read. You're on the tube or the train or something and you're reading it and you can really plow through on Kindle. It's great.
Because people would take out their phones and go on social media and read through the timeline or scroll through Instagram or whatever. But if you can kind of like take that habit and put it into the Kindle app, you're going to get through.
Get Kindle on your phone. It'll change your life.
Definitely.
Yeah. I had to read... Middlemarch. And I just couldn't.
Sorry.
I just couldn't get through it.
Oh, no.
And what I had to do is I got an audiobook.
Okay.
And there was an actress reading it. And it was so annoying because they weren't very good. And I was reading along with it because I was so vexed. And then I got to 100 pages and went, I've got this now. And then I carried on reading. But an audiobook for the first 100 pages of a difficult book is a really good thing to discipline yourself. But audiobooks can be brilliant.
They're amazing.
I highly recommend mine.
Exactly.
And Nancy Boys, My Name is Leon. Please buy them. They're marvellous.
Great. So that's all we have time for today. But we thank everyone for coming, and we've been mostly lit.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Our shows every Monday on Twitter, we're at Mostly Lit. Instagram, we're at Mostly Lit Pod. And then you can find out everything that we're doing from there on. But yeah, each Monday we put a show out. So make sure you listen. iTunes, Google Play, wherever.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Really nice to meet you guys.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.